The sun's energy provides just enough fuel to maintain life on Earth. Reduce slightly the amount of sunlight the Earth receives, and life on our planet would freeze. Increase the sunlight by a very small amount, life would perish, baked by sudden exposure to lethal radiation. For millions of years, the Earth's atmosphere has regulated the amount of solar energy reaching the planet's surface. This has allowed life to prosper and evolution to proceed. But now the delicate balance between planet and star seems to be changing. Chlorine-containing halocarbons are depleting the ozone layer. The fossil fuels we burn have been adding too much carbon monoxide dioxide to the air, changing the climate. Although scientists are still unsure if changes in global weather patterns reflect what we call the greenhouse effect, most agree that something is happening as the result of human action, and that that something is not good. Many believe we will have to move on a number of fronts very quickly to make sure we don't make this planet uninhabitable unintentionally. This is Susan McGinnis, host of KUAC FM's Sunday at Noon. For the next hour, you're invited to join me for a discussion with five-term Republican Congresswoman from Rhode Island, Claudine Schneider. Representative Schneider has introduced a Global Warming Prevention Act for consideration by Congress. Her position? We can act now to slow global warming, or we can gamble on our ability to adapt. The gamble, she believes, is too great for the taking. Representative Schneider, thank you for joining us on Sunday at Noon.
Delighted to be with you.
Good. We'll learn more about the act you're submitting to Congress in the next hour, but I wonder if you can begin by giving us your perspective on the changing climate. What's happening to us here?
Well, I'm a member of the Science and Technology Committee, and I have been for about the last 9 years. And what's interesting is that over the last 9 years, we have been hearing in Congress, and I know long before my own exposure to this, that the scientists are concluding that there appears to be a trend of the Earth's atmosphere heating up. There is also growing evidence, as I'm sure most of your listeners are aware, of the hole in the ozone layer as a result of us putting more and more chemicals into the Earth's atmosphere. And then, of course, the impact of the loss of tropical rainforest and its the landmass interaction with the atmosphere and the oceans is one which we must also monitor. So the scientific interactions of land, air, and sea are one that is leading us to believe that the Earth's atmosphere very well may continue to heat up. And as a result of that, we're going to have to recognize that we must immediately take some actions to prevent further degradation of our planet and, to a great degree, attempt to figure out what actions we must take in those areas where we may not be able to prevent the damage, but rather where we must adapt.
Is there any conclusion? Now, this is something I've listened for and not heard, as to how long we have on this planet before things are too dangerous to go on?
Well, I think that the scientists all agree that the evidence, the scientific evidence, is clear that we are moving toward a heating up of the Earth's atmosphere. The potential impact on the environment is also very clear, that we know that it would affect agriculture and energy and human health as we are reducing the ozone layer, which is Earth's protective shield. We have already begun to see an increase in skin cancers, respiratory diseases, a whole plethora of physical ailments. Also, we have to keep in mind that until we better understand the Earth as a global system and all of the interactions of this system, it's going to be very difficult for us to take preventive measures. But I would say that there is a unanimous agreement among all scientists that the Earth's atmosphere is going to heat up. Now, where the disagreement comes is to how many degrees and over what time period. My point of view as a policymaker is that I can't wait for all of the scientists to reach a final agreement that it's going to increase by 1 degree or 2 degree over whatever time period, because by that time it may be too late for the wheels of Congress to get moving to take any action. Oftentimes, I mean, even if you look at the first Earth Day, which was in 1970, almost 20 years ago, we were talking about water pollution then. We were talking about air pollution, about litter. That's all been translated now into disposal of solid waste. And to some degree, we have a few states that are taking initiative on recycling. But recycling is not part of our lifestyle yet. And this is 20 years later. If we are going to have to make some changes, either in terms of lifestyle or in terms of technology, then we've got to begin today. I work under the philosophy that when a scientist tells you, for example, or when there is some scientific consensus, for example, that cigarette smoking may be detrimental to your health, I'm going to listen very cautiously, because even if there's a hint that it may be detrimental to my health, I'm going to be very inclined to give up smoking if I were a smoker. I'm not. One who is in a policy position, if the scientists are saying that the actions that man happens to be taking may be detrimental to the survival of this planet, I am not going to wait a second further to, you know, see when and to what extent.
So from your perspective, this
the time
planet is
now
a smoker and we're ignoring warnings.
That's it.
The National Academy of Science recently called on George Bush to take a leadership role in the world regarding global warming, and also said that he should take certain prudent measures in public policy.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a summary available of those prudent measures? What does the National Academy of Science say we should do?
They are forthcoming. I mean, the actions on the part of the president are forthcoming. The National Academy has recommended a variety of different actions on the part of the administration, because clearly we do need leadership. But it is interesting that the very first speech that was given by our Secretary of State was a speech on global warming. And the United States is part of an international effort to do three things. Essentially, to define the problem. Secondly, to define possible impacts. And thirdly, to recommend mitigating measures. And the United States is chairing the panel, or the group, international group discussion, to define the actions that ought to be taken. Quite clearly, those actions fall into a number of specific categories, one being to reduce the consumption or the use of fossil fuels. In doing that, clearly our opportunities for using energy overall more efficiently ought to be part of the consideration. And another piece of leadership relates to the reforestation in our country and to carry that message globally. So the president will be forthcoming with a number of different actions, but how many of those remain to be seen. I do know that he has some plans to move ahead in the area of reforestation. But
in our country?
In our country, yes.
What areas of the nation are deforesting?
Well,
is that a verb?
What we have to keep in mind is that even though we may be more of a problem of contributing to the gases and to the release of carbon dioxide, one of the measures, and deforestation may not be a major part of our domestic problem, we can help solve part of the global problem by planting trees also, whereas we cannot control what Brazil is doing in the Amazon, so we can offset that to some degree by tree planting. To me, that is politically one of the easier steps that can be made here in the United States. It's one of the more positive actions that can be taken. One of the more difficult actions to be taken relate to our use of energy and our massive consumption of energy. Clearly, the United States has to take a leadership role by our actions. It will not do well for the United States as a great industrial leader to say, thou shalt do this and you must do that. Our actions must speak louder than our words.
In other areas of the world, I recall some months ago Prime Minister Thatcher called together both houses of parliament and said, my scientists have talked to me, global warming is a major problem, we shall make it a priority in our government.
Right.
My memory is that the new leader in Pakistan also said that she would make it a priority for her nation.
Right.
Where else in the world is leadership showing
throughout,
in these nations and others?
Throughout much of Western Europe, the Germans, at the behest of the Green Party, have been very vocal in saying that this is going to be their top initiative. In addition to that, we've seen France very vocal. So I think it's exciting, personally, that we are seeing the pressure coming from our allies and others saying, mm-hmm. all right, let's get going on it. This past week, I participated in a historic event, and that was the satellite hookup between members of Congress and members of the Supreme Soviet. And in addition to this Congress-to-Congress program, which was hosted by Peter Jennings, we also expanded that program to include a parliamentarian from Brazil and a parliamentarian from England. Mm-hmm. The purpose of this show was to discuss environmental degradation and to see where we can find some common ground. So the Soviet Union is also very interested in moving ahead on addressing the problems of global pollution in general and global warming in particular. Mm-hmm. So I think that the real challenge here is that if you look at the contributors to the problem, it's clearly the United States and the Soviet Union are the leading contributors to the problem.
Wouldn't you say for size, China also?
China is coming fast and furious on our heels, particularly because of their very aggressive plans for modernization. The goal of having a refrigerator in every home in China is one which concerns us for two reasons. One, because of the release of CFCs, and two, because of the energy that would be required to power those refrigerators, and that energy, more likely than not, is going to be coming from the coal industry, the burning mm-hmm. of coal. So they too are an enormous contributor and will become increasingly detrimental to the whole global picture. So when you look at we being the contributors, it's ridiculous for us to get caught, as unfortunately happened with some of our U.S. senators going to South America and telling the Brazilians they should stop cutting down the rainforest. Well, I think that diplomatically that was not the most appropriate move to take. We know it needs to end, but once again, we will have no credibility unless the industrialized nations get together and take some action. And in the process of taking this action, it's critical that we involve the developing countries in the discussions, because my guess is as we look toward the future, we're going to have to negotiate. Much as we have been negotiating on arms control, I can foresee the United States, the Soviet Union, sitting down at a table with Brazil, with Malaysians, with people from Madagascar, and saying, all right, we will reduce mm-hmm. our energy use by 3%, but we would also like to see a comparable move on your part to set aside some of your tropical areas for a debt swap to help remove third world debt. So I think that we're going to have to put a number of cards on the table, and they're going to expect commitments from us as well as us expecting them from them.
And this economic trump card is one that you are drawing all the way through this act you're proposing.
Absolutely. Yeah. The one thing that sets my global warming bill apart from any of the others that you may have heard about that have come down the line mm-hmm. is that mine's the only one that does a cost-benefit analysis. And being a Republican, I feel very strongly, and being a policymaker, very strongly, that we've got to look closely at how we spend our money as a government, because for us to consistently call on taxpayers to increase their taxes to do one thing or another, I think is irresponsible if we can take some cost-effective measures. And then secondly, policies that we'll be proposing have to fit the pocketbook of the consumer in general. So what we do in this bill is to define the sources of the problem. And those sources are essentially three. 33% of the problem is a result of utilities burning, for the most part, fossil fuels. 31% of the problem comes from the transportation sector. And then about 29% comes from the commercial and residential sector. So what we do is we take those sources of the problem and we line them up with appropriate solutions. So let's look at utilities for a moment, and we'll say, all right, what is the most cost-effective substitute for the burning of some of our fossil fuels? The most cost-effective substitute is what is called energy efficiency. Energy efficiency means light bulbs that will burn 10 times longer and use 1/4 of the electricity that is typically found in light bulbs.
And there are fluorescents existing today that do just that.
Absolutely.
Right?
All of the technology that I'll be mentioning to you and all of the technology referred to in the bill is in existence today. So it means using that technology that we have at hand now. Much of it has been developed by our national laboratories, but there has been a very slow process in information transfer and technology transfer to the consumer. We have got to hustle to get that information out quickly so we can begin to minimize the impact of global warming. But back to the solution, the most cost-effective solution to satisfy the utility requirements right now is this energy efficiency technology. The second ranked in cost-effectiveness would be renewable resources, meaning solar, meaning hydro, meaning biomass,
wind.
Yeah. And then the third form of energy would be gas. And all the other energy sources after that, coal, oil, nuclear, are ranked much lower because they are much more expensive.
And those are the top ranked.
Exactly.
Top used.
Right. So our nation is pursuing a domestic policy now that is using the most expensive energy that we have available.
I want to back up and ask you a question that's been on my mind since I started researching this show.
Yes.
First, let me tell people who've tuned in late, that this is Sunday at Noon. I'm Susan McGinnis, your host, and we're talking today with Representative Claudine Schneider. She is a 5-term congresswoman from the state of Rhode Island, Republican congresswoman. She's co-chair of the Congressional Competitiveness Caucus and vice chair of the Subcommittee on Natural Resources, Agriculture Research, and Environment of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. That's a mouthful.
It really is.
I'll say that again in a moment. It seems to me that perhaps beginning with Earth Day in 1970, there's been a philosophy in this country that conservation is painful and it's a drag. It's going to be...
I'm thrilled you're asking this.
the Jimmy Carter during the oil crisis said, this is the bullet, we have to bite it. It is painful.
Mm-hmm.
Ronald Reagan, if I can quote him accurately, said, conservation means being too cold in the winter and too hot in the summertime.
Right.
And I expect that Joe and Jane on the street believe that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, from this package of papers, you're saying this is not true. Is conservation painful? Why
Susan,
or why not?
You are asking the most astute question on this topic that I have been asked in a long time, because that is the challenge underlying this legislation, underlying solving the problem. And that challenge is, how do we change the mindset of the American people and all the people of the world? Because the thought is, if we tell the people that are living in the tropics, no, don't cut down your rainforest, the assumption is we're telling them, no, we don't want you to become a developed nation.
Right.
And if you're going to protect the environment, it's going to make you suffer or it's going to cost you. This is not at all the case. And this is something that I am trying very hard to get the message out, and I'm hopeful that this president will understand. This mindset was a topic that I had just recently with the Indian ambassador and with two other U.S. government officials recently. And someone had said that, it doesn't appear to be macho to be one who conserves energy.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, Mr. Reagan did take the solar panels off of the White House that Jimmy Carter had put on. It sort of fits into that old cliche that real men don't eat quiche.
Right.
Well, there are a whole lot of us that happen to know that a real man is a balanced man, and a real man does eat quiche. And what it reflects is a better understanding that if one is truly knowledgeable about our energy options, then you know that perhaps the softer path, which might be conservation, is more cost-effective and less degrading to the environment, and is clearly our best option for a variety of reasons. So, how do you persuade the American public that it is going to be a comfortable transition to do the right thing by giving them the information. For example, how difficult is it to ride a car that gets 90 miles per gallon instead of one that gets 22 miles per gallon?
More money in my pocketbook.
Exactly.
For one.
Exactly. But you see, the American auto industry has let down the American people. They have been, instead of sending their engineers to the hearing rooms in Congress, which is what the Japanese do, our hearing rooms are filled with Japanese engineers. But at the same time, it's filled with American lawyers who are representing the auto industry and trying to figure out how is the industry going to get around the law. Now, really, I don't want to have to go and buy foreign cars once again. At one time, I drove a Volkswagen Rabbit because it got 52 miles per gallon. Now, driving an American car that barely gets 22, that's a real step backward for me. And as a consumer, I resent the fact, because I further know, as a member of the Science and Tech Committee, and as a member of the Competitiveness Caucus, that not only have the Japanese developed a Toyota that gets 90 miles per gallon, and they're waiting for it to all hit the fan for us to buy those cars, but Volvo has also developed a car that gets 75 miles per gallon, meets the EPA crash standards and the air emission standards, and is going to be comparable in price to their standard midsize Volvo.
And you don't have your knees up to your Adam's apple when
exactly,
driving.
Exactly, exactly.
Which is so, the other myth.
Yeah, and as you point out, the assumption is you have to suffer or it's going to cost you, and that is not so. It doesn't, for example, in the area of energy efficiency and the light bulbs we were mentioning, yes, the light bulbs that I referred to do cost more up front, but the money that the light bulb that I'm thinking of in particular is one that cost approximately $10 if you were to be able to find it in a hardware store. The reason that it costs so much now is because there is not enough of a demand for it. Once the demand would go up, just like for handheld calculators, the price would come down. But right now, these light bulbs are primarily sold to the commercial sector for skyscrapers, office buildings, that sort of thing. But you pay $10 up front, and you end up saving $50 in your electric bill. And it lasts much longer, so that the replacement costs are less, particularly in the commercial sector. You know, you don't have to pay an employee to go around the building and change all the light bulbs as frequently. So there are many costs that are avoided.
So how do we convince General Motors and General Electric,
yes,
in terms of cars and light bulbs, that this is good for us and
okay,
we should do it? I'm not sure they're going to do it because it's good for us.
Well, I'll tell you, the General Electric, we don't have to convince, because they are the one company, and you picked a good one, that happens to be leading the way right now on the domestic level. The General Electric has developed such a light bulb that is extremely energy efficient, and they did this because they saw that the Swedes were also moving ahead with this, and they recognize that there could be market potential. So General Electric has developed a great light bulb. The auto industry, how are we going to persuade them? Well, I'll tell you this. I just did an interview yesterday with the National Journal. I don't know that it's distributed here in Alaska, but the article that I think is going to be the beginning of many more articles nationwide really is picking on the auto industry. And for my two cents, I said that I don't want to have to vote to bail out Chrysler again. I don't want to have to vote to bail out GM. It's bad enough we're bailing out the savings and loan institutions. It's bad enough that we're looking at the increasing health care costs that we're going to have to deal with. And we do have to bail out the nuclear industry now because of the mess that they have left at many of the defense installations and their, you know, inexcusable expenditures there to the tune of perhaps between $90 and $200 billion. Mm. So I think that we're going to have to call on the media and the consumers to start beating up on the auto industry, because from Congress we're trying to do what we can to push them. For example, in my legislation, it calls for our fleet obtaining 45 miles per gallon by 1995. That is not at all much to ask, but yet that is the one piece of my legislation that is receiving the greatest opposition and the hardest lobbying of all the different components.
By the oil and gas industry?
Primarily by the auto industry, but perhaps by the oil and gas industry behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. So when I speak with the American auto industry, they say, well, Claudine, you know, the consumer doesn't care about auto efficiency anymore. And for my own part, I get very resentful when I turn on the television set and see commercials for automobiles, and they show us how fast they are or how they can climb up mountains of rocks. Mm-hmm. I mean, how absurd. The people that I know want cars that I would think, particularly here in Alaska, that would have very good fuel efficiency. And in the urban areas where you can have cars that were not only fuel efficient, but were non-polluting, because we are killing ourselves in our urban centers. There's no question about it. Los Angeles is only the tip of the iceberg. So I think that, you know, the consumers can say, no, no, you know, do you have a fuel-efficient car? I want to know what the impact on the environment is. So that's one way we can do it, and the media can also start beating up on them, and then we in Congress can continue to push this legislation and let it be known that it's the auto industry that's lobbying, and let's hear from consumers. We want those cards and letters and outrage on the radio talk shows.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now let's move to what an associate of yours has called the tie-in strategy, which is to tie work in preventing global warming with economic benefit to the nation and its citizens.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, he has said that this tie-in strategy can reduce the trade deficit.
Absolutely.
In what other ways will this operate, tying in?
Well, let me mention a little bit about the trade deficit so your listeners will understand exactly how we can do better. When I mentioned that we ranked the cost of substituting for the utilities, you know, the coal and oil and nuclear, with the most cost-effective, which are energy-efficient technologies and renewables. Right now, we are in a situation where the United States had targeted 10 overseas markets where we wanted to excel in high technology. Of those 10, most of them were energy-related. I am sad to report that we have already lost out in being the number one exporter in 7 out of those 10 markets. And that means in the areas of lighting, in motors, in refrigerators, in refrigeration technologies, those kinds of areas that are energy related, but yet we have been excelled in the foreign marketplace by the Japanese or by the West Germans. When you move into the area of renewable resources, the last American developer of photovoltaic cells, of solar cells, has been Atlantic Richfield, and they just recently sold off their share, and so now there is no longer a U.S. manufacturer of solar cells. So that when the time comes that the Americans decide, yes, this is something that we want to invest in, unfortunately, just like our TVs and our VCRs, we're going to be buying from the Japanese. I happen to feel that U.S. investment in energy research is our best hedge against our deficit and trade deficit that we can take, because there's going to be growing global pressure from all nations saying, all right, Americans, you're using more energy than any other nation on Earth, despite your population being a smaller population, and we resent you, Americans, for doing that. So shape up. And when it comes time that we decide, yes, for our own prestige or for international security purposes, we had better shape up, unfortunately, it's going to cost us more, because we're going to start doing it by making purchases from the Germans, mm-hmm. from the Japanese, and other nations. So that's unfortunate. We could have a win-win strategy now where we could not only be selling the light bulbs in the U.S. to all of our own consumers and saving our people money, but also in terms of exporting these goods. Another area that is a win-win situation, not only economically but environmentally, is a result of the legislation that I have proposed, because not only do we rank the solutions on the cost but also on environmental impact. So if you look at what is the best technology substitute for the utilities environmentally, you once again find energy efficiency, renewables, and gas to be the best environmentally. So when you try to come up with the best solutions. For example, tree planting in the United States is not only going to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that is ultimately going into the atmosphere, but you are also going to reduce the amount of air conditioning that it might be needed. What we're finding now, there are such things as that are called heat islands, particularly in cities where you have very intense heat buildup as a result of the reflection of the sun, and you know the pavement heats up. And so the more trees that you are planting in these urban areas, in the cities, not only are you reducing the amount of carbon dioxide that's getting into our lungs and into the atmosphere, but you're also providing a cooling agent where you can reduce the amount of need for refrigeration purposes or air conditioning purposes.
I had a conversation, I believe in March, with Dr. Arthur Rosenfeld, who's a physicist from UC Berkeley.
Right.
He has been working with the city of Los Angeles on an idea, and I'm not sure whether it's his or an idea that's spread among several people, to plant 5 million trees in the Los Angeles citywide area, so I think city and county. And once those 5 million trees are planted, he believes that the number of heat islands, the amount of pollution, will begin to reduce just by the fact that the trees will cleanse.
Absolutely.
And the air conditioning needs will be reduced dramatically around Los Angeles. I'm not sure whether this is going into effect, but it's certainly something being considered.
I can't speak specifically for Los Angeles, but my guess is it is going to go into effect, given the crises management they have to do right now. But the other thing that I'm excited about is that the American Forestry Association has initiated a program which, by the way, we're seeing the private sector also get involved in by the Gallo winemakers, because this week I just kicked off an effort where Gallo Wine has volunteered to contribute enough number of dollars to plant trees throughout the United States. And the goal is to plant about, be part of an effort to plant about 5 billion trees. And it's my understanding also that the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of the Interior, and the President of the United States himself is looking at a plan to mobilize Americans to plant more trees. And I think that this is the kind of presidential leadership that I think all of us would applaud. In China, incidentally, it is a tradition to plant a tree on your birthday, at least one tree. I've heard from some that it's 3 trees that one should plant. Clearly, they need to really get going on that in China, given the population growth in that country and given the deforestation and the use of coal. So, but the Art Rosenfeld is really a national leader and a national treasure when it comes to energy efficiency, and his plan for Los Angeles is very well thought out, and he's extremely well respected in this field. So we ought to model that in many other cities throughout the United States.
We're talking to Representative Claudine Schneider from Rhode Island. We're taking a look today at her Global Warming Prevention Act, which is to be submitted to Congress this year. It's been introduced to Congress, but it's being submitted in this next term. Her concern is that global warming is going to be a great threat to humankind, and her aim is to create economic incentives for reducing the effect of global warming. You started a minute ago to talk about electric utilities, and I want to, let's begin there and then just kind of march through your act if we can.
Okay.
One of the, it has been traditional, I suppose, in utilities regulation and management, that more is better. Mm-hmm. If we use, the more kilowatt hours we use, the more power plants can be built, the more money goes into the utilities and thus into government, and the more jobs we have for people.
Right.
This isn't working anymore.
Wrong assumption.
Yeah.
Wrong.
But it has been the major assumption behind
absolutely.
Them.
So now what we are seeing is that many utilities are participating in what is called least cost planning. And interestingly enough, for this part of the world, this came about during the whoops problem that happened in the Pacific Northwest in Washington State and Oregon, et cetera, when they found that the plans to build more nuclear power plants were going to be so costly and the consumer was not willing to pay for it, Congress mandated that first this region must look at least cost options. And much to their surprise, they learned that, my God, we could provide, you know, the same amount of electricity and energy that would be required at only much less cost and less environmental impact. And so they displaced the need for, I think it was about 18 different nuclear and coal and oil-fired plants.
At several $1 billion apiece.
Right? Absolutely, absolutely. So now we are seeing the least cost planning approach has become a real cliche in energy planning circles sweep across the country. Pacific Gas and Electric in the California region has really been one of the national leaders in this. And we've got some California leaders who have come to my part of the world, to New England, and we've started what's called the Boston Co-op, where we've gotten together the major users like Raytheon, like MIT University, and a number of other, and some of the hospitals. The biggest energy users have all come together, and they are doing least cost planning to determine how they can reduce their energy consumption, either by changing the time usage of their energies, such as off-peak planning, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing, which doesn't pain you and does not cost you anything additional. And then the second phase, too, is to figure out how they can use more energy efficiency technology with either thermostats or with replacing of light bulbs or replacing of windows or just using heat recycling systems or whatever type of technology might be most appropriate. So we're seeing least cost planning be an initiative that I think will eventually be part of the norm in our national energy usage plan. There are some utilities now that find it more cost effective, such as the Tennessee Valley Authority, that had been building many nuclear power plants and had been a strong nuclear advocate, suddenly saying, my God, we haven't figured out what we're going to do with the waste yet. In many discussions where I have been, they've said, well, let's put it all in Alaska, you know, nothing will, no one will worry about it there, I know. I'm sure you'd be thrilled to hear that.
Sent the prisoners to Australia, now they'll send
yes.
the garbage to Alaska. It's far away. I mean,
but that's the mentality we've been mm-hmm. dealing with. So we have to shift for our own good, shift that mentality from out of sight, out of mind, to saying, wait a minute, we're not going to generate this to begin with. So what we found is that, back to the TVA, their utilities are handing out light bulbs to consumers, and they are giving rebates for those consumers that purchase energy-efficient refrigerators or energy-efficient air conditioners or whatever it might be. And in my own state of Rhode Island, we're seeing more and more of a trend toward that direction. They have focused now on the commercial and industrial sector, where they are coming in. The utility company is coming in and saying, oh, look, you know, you can change this water wheel, or you can do this and that and use your energy more efficiently. So it's, in the end, it's not more energy is better for the utility companies, because they're finding that they're going to have to pay in a variety of environmental costs and in putting on scrubbers or doing all kinds of things. So times are changing, and those people who are really going to thrive are the ones that are ahead of the time. And there is a saying by the Chinese that in life, chance favors the prepared mind. So if we are prepared mentally to understand what's coming down the pike, we can all be winners.
I understand that California and Maine have in some ways led the way in changing utility regulations to promote least cost,
Absolutely.
Promote rebates, promote less use of energy. Is there a way that Alaska or Texas or South Dakota can learn from what Maine and California are doing? Is there any way to transfer some of this
yes.
information around?
Good question. You must have been reading my actions over the past couple of years, because the frustration is, when you say Alaska or Texas, the assumption is, well, wait a second, our fuel, which is primarily oil, is so cheap. Why should we look elsewhere? You know, we are our state economies are dependent on this cheap fuel. Well, the fact is that, once again, the changing the mindset in the energy producing states is much more of a challenge. But there is a way that if the Alaskans should decide, well, we want to do both, you know, we'll use some of the oil, but we want to use it more efficiently to stretch it out, to make it last longer, just in case we'll need it further down the line. There is a center at the Federal Department of Energy, and I had gotten funding for this a couple of years ago, and it's called the Least Cost Planning Initiative, and we've been attempting to set up an electronic bulletin board so that with a phone call or with your computer, you could plug into the federal government's office of Least Cost Planning and find out what is the state of the art, for example, for heating purposes. What is the most energy efficient technology for your factory, and how much would it cost, and where do you find it, who manufactures it, that kind of thing. So it is an information transfer system. It is not up and running as well as I would like it to. Regrettably, there has been some foot dragging over the last couple of years, but Admiral Watkins, our new Secretary of Energy, has indicated that he's anxious to get this program running again.
Several of the utilities, for example, in Maine and in California, are embracing these ideas.
Yes.
Are there any who, like private industry in other areas, are standing tough and saying the old ways are the best ways and we knew what we were doing when we started this trip?
Not in terms of energy efficiency at all. Okay. I mean, they're really seeing the economics. And I think this is what we have to understand, if I might just divert a moment to a broader philosophical change that is taking place, is that we have thought in the past on the part of industry and certainly the utility industry, the energy industry, that it's, we can figure out how to do it. It's going to cost us more, and we really don't want to spend more money to be more energy efficient. But what we're finding now is that the private sector is leading the way. And that goes across the board, even in dealing with things like hazardous waste. 3M, Dow, DuPont, all of these chemical manufacturers have realized that they are able to make incredible dollar savings by recycling or using their hazardous waste. Mm-hmm. And right now we have the technology to recycle or reuse anywhere between 50% and 75% of all of our hazardous waste. So 3M in particular has saved millions of dollars, reduced the amount of water that they, clean water that they've used in the industrial process, and saved millions of gallons of wastewater, or billions rather. They have saved enormous amounts of energy, and the cost savings to them as an industry has been spectacular. And this is true of many other industries too. I'm using large examples so that your listeners can relate to them, but in my own state of Rhode Island, we are the nation's leading costume jewelry manufacturer, which means that we use a lot of alloys and electroplating, and we also do a lot in the area of plastics. And even the very small family manufacturers, you know, of 25 people or so, are finding that it's more cost-effective for them to put in the equipment to recycle their waste than it is to try to dispose of it and take an alternative approach. And we have to acknowledge that, too, as consumers, because if we reduce at the source or if we recycle, it is going to save us later cleanup costs because, as you know, we are paying big bucks, many billions of dollars, into the Superfund. And Superfund has yet, we've only cleaned up 24 sites in the United States, and we have many thousands of sites to go yet. So we're paying in our taxes to clean up the mess we've created after the fact. But what we're finding now is we're also having to pay in health care costs because epidemiological studies are showing that in many of those areas where we have had either disposal of waste that have gotten into the groundwater, or I'm sure we're going to find in Los Angeles and other areas, increase pollutants into the atmosphere, that there will be an increase in not only respiratory ailments, but the numbers of cancers and other related diseases. So once again, that adds to our nation's health costs.
If we can just make these connections.
Yes. Well, that's what I'm trying to do.
It's not like getting hit by a car. If you get hit by a car, you're clearly hit.
Yes,
and you're
you've
broken.
Got the message, right.
Yeah, don't. If there is a cancer or a heart disease or something growing in me now, we're just sitting here having a comfortable conversation, and
right.
I won't know about it for 6 months or 5 years.
Right, until you see a symptom.
Right.
And what we are trying to do, or what I'm trying to express, is that we've got symptoms all over the place for global warming. Mother Earth has got a fever. And she is sending out those symptoms. What we have to do is take a holistic view and to recognize that the drought that we had last year in the Midwest, that some of the fires that we have had in California and in Colorado, but even the flooding that we have experienced in Bangladesh, the rise of the sea level in certain parts of the world, that all of these are symptoms that Mother Earth is telling us, hey, wake up, pay attention. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm on my sick bed, and unless you take some action instead of sitting there silently, I'm going to die. And our planet's survival is at stake. Now, that might sound like a pretty dramatic message, but being in the government, any cynic on the outside can say, oh, God, government moves so slowly. Well, yes, it does. I can tell you that from the inside. But the only thing that can make Congress move faster in pushing policies happens to be the people. If the people don't lobby, if the people don't visit their congressmen or their senators, or they don't say, look, we want you to be a co-sponsor of Claudine Schneider's bill on global warming, that bill is going to languish mm-hmm. for years because the industry is lobbying. You better believe it. You know, those lobbyists are standing outside the doors in Congress waiting to nab us if we walk out the door for a minute. So it really is dependent upon the grassroots and upon the media. So what really infuriates me is when people say, oh, well, you know, what can one person do? Well, I'll tell you what one person can do. You can join one of the national organizations if you're not already a member. There is something called the Greenhouse Foundation, and they've put out a book that has 101 different examples of things that you can do to help mitigate the problem yourself. One of the things is to drive a fuel-efficient car. Another thing is not to get involved in burning fuel, fossil fuels, but rather be very energy efficient in all respects. Plant a tree is another easy thing to do. When you go to buy your consumer goods and you find that there's a lot of packaging that you have to dispose of, recycling, you know, is clearly one way to minimize the problem, but just consuming those things is something. So write to the manufacturers that they should, you know, find more appropriate packaging or reduce some of the packaging.
Some people have recommended that recipients send back all those styrofoam chips.
I think it's a terrific idea.
Harry and David, send your
But
food
don't
to
say
you.
I recommended it.
Those words were not heard coming from the lips of Claudine Schneider.
Right.
You are listening to Representative Claudine Schneider. She's a five-term congresswoman from Rhode Island. We're talking about her Global Warming Prevention Act and also about her beliefs relative to the economy and how it can work also to resolve global warming.
It's a win-win situation. I know. It is a warming and a warning.
Clearly.
But it can be a win-win situation. And the way we realize that is just to begin, you know, to take some action. Somebody plants a tree, they do it because they think they're doing something good for the Earth's atmosphere. But then they'll find out, you know, that will have a multiple effect. Mm-hmm. You'll have more birds in your yard.
That's true.
Yeah. You know, it may provide some shade and reduce your energy cost. A whole variety of things. So I'm enthused about people picking up on this information.
Let's return to the federal scene for a moment and talk about research and development.
Mm-hmm.
This is another major plank of your act, much like that relative to utilities. Research and development is addressed in your act in terms of transportation, and we've also already talked a bit about automobiles. It's research and development is a major issue in your act in terms of discovering new ways to use renewable resources.
Right.
There's a problem here.
What's that?
Now I'm not going to remember my numbers as well as I should, but I'll try. Department of Energy, here's one, spends
mm-hmm.
$50 million on all transportation research and development, and yet the nation spends $100 billion each year on gas.
Mm-hmm.
The Department of Energy has something less than $190 million in its request for budget in 1990 for renewable resource research and development. Whereas in 1979, during the Carter years, there was $800 million being given to that. How do we, this is an overall question, and if you can address it in terms of research and development, I think it will be helpful.
Okay.
How do we, if the Carter administration puts in $800 million, or X times whatever mm-hmm. we've got for transportation on research and development now, how do we get a 25-year or a 50-year plan going to help this planet mm-hmm. if the administration that follows the Carter administration, in this case the Reagan administration, mm-hmm. says, oh, no, no, kids, you don't need that. We'll cut it in half.
Right.
Or we'll cut it by two-thirds. And I'm not picking necessarily on Ronald Reagan because we don't know
but that is what
George
happened.
Bush is going yeah. to do or what the next president is going to do. Mm-hmm. How do we make a long-term plan when we're trying to research if money's going to be taken away because of the vagaries of political ideology?
Well, unfortunately, that is a major problem. And so now we are going to have to make up for that last 8 years. Unfortunately, where the funds had been cut by 90% for energy efficiency research and by 75% for renewables. That's hard to make up. And unfortunately, the private sector, you know, has not been interested if the federal government hasn't been interested. And we also reduced, you know, energy conservation tax credits. So even the consumer has not put much importance on it. So it really has to come from presidential leadership. And I'm spending a lot of my own personal time and energy trying to persuade this administration that this is the path we must take. But I think that as they hear it from others, in addition to my own lone voice, I think that they will begin to realize the cost effectiveness and the environmental importance of it and the international diplomatic importance of it. Where do we begin? Right now, we have to make up for lost time in research and development. And in my legislation, we call for a 3-year authorization for the R&D program for a minimum of $805 million. And we would also require that the Department of Energy prepare a report that would detail the long-term, as you asked about, the long-term R&D program and policy options to achieve a doubling, a tripling, and a quadrupling of national renewable energy use by the year 2015. So this is a component I am forcing in this legislation, mm-hmm. long-term thinking, and hopefully a long-term commitment to support that thinking in the research and development area. The reason that I wanted to include that is that the Department of Energy has even financed studies themselves that note that renewable resources constitute one of America's largest energy reserves, over 80,000 quads a year, which is over 5 times America's coal reserves.
80,000 quads. That's a reference to quadrillion, is that right?
Yes.
And it's units of energy, BTUs?
Yep.
Sounds like something to the next step for the deficit is the quadrillion.
Right. But what's interesting is that those 80,000 quads, which, as I mentioned, are 5 times larger than our coal reserves, mm-hmm. are actually 80% of what our projected energy needs are by the year 2010. 80% from renewable resources. We have that potential. And this information has come from studies that the Department of Energy has financed. So for us to ignore our own research about the potential that we have from renewables is completely irresponsible. So
the theory here is that if we use conservation techniques for the next 20 to 25 years and at the same time devote enough money mm-hmm. and enough intellectual resources to research and development mm-hmm. regarding renewable resources, that by the year 2015 or mm-hmm. so, we will be able to supply
yes.
what we need. We bridge now to have later
right.
and at the same time protect the environment.
Exactly. Now, you see, the greatest criticism that our country has gotten is that we're the me society, that mm-hmm. we're here today, gone tomorrow, that, instant gratification. Now, what is that costing us? Well, it's costing us an enormous trade deficit with Japan, for example, because the Japanese do long-range planning, and they might make an investment in their R&D where they won't realize the benefits of it for 10 or 20 years. But you see, our businesses nor our government has been willing to do that. And so we as consumers have to be willing to say, all right, you know, it's sort of like savings. We have the lowest savings rate in the world, one of the lowest savings rates in the world. And
yeah,
it's because
less than 2% or 1%
right.
this year, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. So our failure to be willing to, you know, put money aside or to invest it for the long term is rather tragic, because what we're finding is our elderly population is then suddenly waking up and saying, well, wait a minute, I can't live on my Social Security check. We need the federal government to pay for catastrophic health. We need the federal government to pay for this and that and that and that. And it's because we haven't planned for the future. And we're, as a nation, are finding that if we don't plan for our energy future and our environmental future, we're going to be the losers. One other thing that I might mention, because we've talked, you know, a bit about solar and cogeneration and a variety of other options, hydro and wind, et cetera, I might also mention that one of the technologies that has been overlooked is one where we can look to the Defense Department for the R&D that they have been involved in. Pratt Whitney has developed a gas turbine engine that we are finding now can be used as an energy generator for biomass. And the reason this is so very important is that it has great applications for the developing world, whereas we in the United States, through the World Bank or through our commercial banks, will say, all right, Brazil, we'll loan you some money, or India, we'll loan you a, you know, $500 million and we'll help you build a dam. Well, when you build a dam, you might cut down 100,000 acres of forest. You're losing the wildlife there. You are also in a situation where the expenditure of dollars is enormous. And if, in fact, we could substitute our loans to these countries instead of saying we're going to help you build a dam and cause damage and displaced indigenous peoples, too, not to mention the tribal people you might be displacing, and say we're going to provide you with some of these old defense gas turbine engines where you can burn your sugar cane or other biomass, you're going to reduce the amount of gases that you're putting into the air. You are going to provide a more cost-efficient option that is not centralized, so you don't need massive distribution systems, but it will be right there for the people in their villages, for their community. So it's much more appropriate technology, and it's one where it would reduce part of our foreign aid budget, too. So once again, it's a win-win situation. We help others, we help ourselves, we help the planet.
Where do you expect the biggest blocks are to this act, and what's your feeling about its success possibility?
Okay, the act has about 12 different components, everything from some of the things we've discussed on energy efficiency and auto efficiency, but it also covers things like reforestation, and it also includes world population growth, which is a key component, and it mentions recycling. So of all those different 12 components, I think the greatest resistance is going to come from primarily the auto industry, number one, as I mentioned, and number two, from the coal industry, because they feel desperate, and it's an effort, once again, to protect jobs, you know, perhaps the fossil fuel industry, coal and oil. But I think that we have to acknowledge that we are at a point where perhaps our country was a number of years ago when the automobile was first being developed. And the blacksmiths were very resistant. You know, they said, wait a minute, what about the horse and buggy? And what about making these wheels? And what about making the riding clothes, and et cetera? And yes, there is employment that will have to be flexible. And that is the name of survival in our country. The high-flex society is the society that is going to survive, the survival of the fittest. And the coal miners and the people involved in the oil industry are going to have to adapt. And they should be the promoters of using energy efficiency, that we can still use our coal and oil reserves. But let's minimize that use today and put more money into the research of using that energy in a more clean and extensive fashion later on. Mm-hmm. So there's no need for us to use the cheapest, the fastest. And that's part of the American ethic, the quick fix. So that's one of the areas that I think will have, you know, some resistance. The other area is in the area that I mentioned, and that's population growth. There is this unfortunate mindset that has been picked up by those who call themselves the pro-life, you know, movement, and they think that if we are going to do family planning, that that immediately translates into abortions. That is absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
And fortunately, the Senate just this week, with the help of Senator Stevens, I'm happy to say, has at least I should verify that. I believe he was, I'm almost 100% certain that he was helpful in the passage of this, of moving through committee the legislation that would allow the United States to once again refund the United Nations Family Planning Program. Of all the United Nations programs, the Family Planning Program is one of the best, because I have been to Africa, I have been to the developing world, and it's so tragic to have women come up to me and say, oh, you're an American, can you help me? How can I have fewer children?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? That's sad. We take that for granted as women in this country, that we know what to do to limit the size of our children. But they don't have the information. They don't have the technology. And yet these women are truly, you know, fifth-class citizens. And sadly, they're the ones that are also destroying the planet, unbeknownst to them, not just because the size of the families that they're having, for example, in Kenya, where the typical family size is 8 children, but they are the ones that have to provide for those children. They're the ones that are going out not only chopping down the trees to provide fire to cook for their children, but they don't know that they should be replanting those trees. Fortunately, there is a woman who has received a number of international awards now. Mathia Wangari, who has been planting trees throughout all of Kenya and trying to teach village women that when they cut down a tree, they need to plant another one or two other ones. So the component of my bill would call for a 5-year authorization for family planning services for the United Nations Population Fund. And it would also call for intervening an international conference on population to better understand the interrelationship between populations and resources, environment, and economic development. They're all tied in, one to another.
Representative Claudine Snyder, our hour has flown.
I'm
very grateful to you for coming and spending time with me. Next week on Sunday at noon, we'll have a program on juvenile waiver. When children commit adult crimes, should they be treated as children or as adults? I hope you'll join me then. This has been Susan McInnes for Sunday at Noon. You're listening to KUAC-FM in Fairbanks, and I hope you have a good Sunday.